Good afternoon and welcome to A Piece of the Action on this 21st of January. Still January. Today we're going to be talking mainly about anti-poverty network issues, the new welfare bill or lack of welfare bill that the federal government is bringing in or trying to bring in. And a couple of aspects of the public transport policy that APN is developing. And if we've got time, we're going to talk a bit about the so-called false alarms that we've been having this week, nuclear false alarms, which actually seem more like deliberate attempts to prepare people for nuclear war. That may or may not happen because this is the priority. But before we go any further, I'd like to acknowledge that we're on Kaurna land and that the Kaurna people have never relinquished their sovereignty, and we respect the spiritual beliefs of the Kaurna people and the Kaurna elders. I have two guests today. One is, both from an anti-poverty network. First of all, Zed. Hi, Zed. How are you?
Hello. How you doing?
Sorry, I don't know your surname. That's why I just called you that.
That's fine.
That's fine with you. And the other is Eileen, whose surname I do know because she's my sister, Eileen Darley. Hi, Eileen.
Hello.
And they're both active in anti-poverty network. And just before I go any further, how do you think anti-poverty network is going after a few years now? How's it travelling, given that Australia is descending into poverty? Not according to the federal government, of course. We're getting higher employment, according to them. But, you know, in the real world, where the governments aren't, how do you think anti-poverty network is going?
It's growing, not surprisingly. It's growing in terms of active members, and it's growing in terms of the outreach that we have. Particularly, we use Facebook a lot, and we find it a medium that it has the capacity to bring an awful lot of people in. And the numbers of the amount of traffic on our Facebook pages is increasing by the day, really. As I say, not surprisingly.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think even the past year we've grown significantly, and I think that's just kind of says how like sick people are of the constant attack on the poor. And yeah, I guess we will talk about that in the new welfare bill, but it seems every bill gets worse and worse.
Well, of course, poverty is increasing at the same time as wealth is increasing at an ever greater rate for a smaller and smaller number of people, but more and more wealthy. So, of course, that's the two must be linked, you'd think, and I'd say so, yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, okay. So we did a story 2 or 3 weeks ago on the welfare bill or the proposed welfare bill that the federal government is bringing forward. But that mainly focused on one aspect, the demerit system. There are other nasties in the bill, embedded in the bill. In fact, the demerit system is almost a little bit of a cover for some of the other things, from what I can understand.
Well, it's just that, like with a lot of these bills, it's geared towards splitting people into interest groups. It may be a better system for some people who are on welfare, and it's going to be a lot worse for others. The status quo as it stands is that if you receive or if you don't turn up to one of your mutual obligation appointments, that could be a meeting, it could be a work for the dole scheme, it could be a training scheme or whatever, there are quite a number of people who are immediately knocked off their payments.
Breached, as they charmingly call it.
Breached, yeah. So, but they have the capacity to go to Centrelink and to ask them to review it. And the numbers are that about 50% of those initial breaches for missing one mutual obligation activity are reversed by Centrelink. Now, this new demerit system.
Just let me clarify.
Yeah.
The breaching is actually done by The job network people.
The job network.
Private companies. Private companies. Cut people off their public welfare.
They inform Centrelink that you didn't turn up.
Technically, and, but
So, yes, the power is in their hands. But at the moment, there is an appeal system where you can go to Centrelink. 50% of those breaches are reversed, but this new demerit system apparently means that Centrelink will no longer be part of it, and no longer will the job network providers be able to exercise discretion. It will just be as simple, you missed an appointment, you lose a demerit point, and so on. Now, for people who have been breached after the loss of or not turning up to one appointment, and that happens for a wide range of reasons, often because people have physical and mental health problems, which is kind of plays into the whole thing of how they've stopped people on being able to access disability pension and pushed them onto Newstart. So for those people, for that strata of people, it's going to be much, much worse.
I think it'll be a lot like the robo debt as well, because it's going to be fully automated, I'm assuming. So as soon as you don't rock up or you're 1 minute late, you'll be breached, but it'll be automatic, so you won't even be able to review that.
So it's, governments like to be able to do that, or no discretion. Oh, sorry, but it's just the way the system is. It's the system. Not us, it's the system. Mm. Yeah.
Now, their spin on it is that people will be able to see it coming more, And for some people, again, that will be true. You get... if you accrue 4 points in 6 months, then you go on to the income breaching. You lose a week of your payment in the first instance, then 2 weeks, then 1 month. So that's their system that they're trying to spin it as if it's a complete improvement, but of course it won't be. For people who are in a position where they can't turn up to these mutual obligation appointments and schemes that work for the Dole schemes and so forth. And there's a lot of people in that position.
And having done it myself, I know exactly what some of these appointments are about. They're about applying for jobs that a lot of people know just aren't there, or they're about doing courses which are absolutely useless.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make myself out to be typical, but I've got two higher degrees in university. Well, I was doing a course on writing resumes. I do know how to write a resume, but it was just part of the process. And of course, it's not unrelated to the fact that I know and you know that the job network people get money every time they get someone to do one of these different kinds of tasks.
Yep.
They put forward, so the incentives there. Okay, so what's what are the other things in the legislation that are looking particularly nasty?
Okay, so there's a maximum liquid assets waiting period, which normally is 13 weeks, is going to be doubled to 26 weeks.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Okay, so what does it mean? It means that when somebody is claiming and they have money in the bank that's equal to or exceeds $18,000 for single parents for singles without dependents, or $36,000 for couples and singles with dependents. That is, people with savings that are around that mark will have to wait 26 weeks now before they can receive any payments. Now, that may seem to some people fair, but actually those bundles of money are all that people have sometimes, particularly people who don't have superannuation, and there's a lot of us, and so forth. So they really effectively want you to spend all of the meagre kind of savings that you've got before you're able to access.
Well, $18,000 for most people is a very low yearly income. So, you know, you'd have to live on very spartanly for that period and then be down to practically nothing.
That's right, which is going to put more people into poverty because they will strictly be dependent on the welfare payments, which are notoriously inadequate, and they'll have no savings in order to back them up.
Yeah. What else?
I think another one worth mentioning, it's a bill, so it has to pass Parliament still, but that will be they're getting rid of the back payment system. So at the moment, you lodge, say you want to get on Centrelink or any kind of welfare payment, and you lodge, and then usually from the date you lodge the claim, you get back paid. So it could be 3 up to months of back pay. And now they're getting rid of that, and they're saying they might put in like a, you'll get reviewed in 2 days. So the max you'll lose is 2 days. But at the moment, we see, you know, it takes up to weeks and months. So if that system did work, you're still, even 2 days is like $100, I think, if you're on Newstart. So
the date is that when you actually put in not just the application, but all your details that you need to provide to them as well.
Yeah, and it'll just be, you'll get your claim when you claimed it, not back paid, or like when they review it, sorry.
So if you can imagine that people that are hospitalised, people that are in situations of domestic violence and so forth, people who don't have IT skills are going to be in a situation where they have to get together all of the paperwork and so forth very, very quickly if they're not to lose payments. It could be weeks for many people.
Well, they either have to phone their bank, and good luck with that, or they have to go into it, I presume, to get the certificate.
Yeah.
Or they get the details of their bank account. I know, that includes separation certificates as well, people need from jobs.
Yes,
I know people who find great difficulty getting a separation ticket. For instance, if an employer has collapsed, if the reason why you're on welfare is because your employer has gone bung, well, good luck getting a separation certificate from an organisation that no longer exists.
Yeah.
You know?
And the amount of money that the government is saying that they're going to save on this is the dead giveaway, really, because it's runs to close to $200 million that they're expecting to save on all of these changes. And can I just say that one of the worst ones too, and this is a change that the Liberals can get through without needing legislative change or even regulatory change, as I understand it, and that is that people in the 30 to 49 bracket will have to increase their mutual obligations from 20 hours before, sorry, by 20 hours, so from 30 to 50 hours. It's draconian. It's really 25 hours a week that you have to be doing a work for the Dole scheme, which are absolutely notorious for exploitation, for lack of safety. It's basically slave labour. I think you get paid something like $20 a fortnight or something extra to do it.
It's ridiculous.
So that's a big one, and that group of people constitutes the largest amount of people who are on Newstart. To something like 207, close to 300,000 people.
So what else would that increased requirement involve? More stupid courses?
Stupid courses, more appointments, work for the Dole. What have I missed out, Zed? Volunteering and paid work as well, which, you know, I mean, obviously that's what people want. So it's a particularly nasty one. Then the other one is that people in a slightly older bracket will lose at the moment from 50 to 60 in that age group. You can actually acquit your mutual obligation by doing 30 hours of voluntary labour. That's no longer available. You have to have 15 of those hours will have to be job activity related, and so that means more training, more Mickey Mouse courses, more volunteering, more work for the Dole.
So much more time.
Yeah.
Especially as you get older. It's insane. And I think that, you know, the attack on youth has been quite brutal over the years. I mean, there hasn't been a race to youth allowance in 30 years, but now we see the New Start, which is also like really low payment, but yeah, you know, like increasing 20 hours is insane. If you're working like and not covering your hours, you're still gonna have to do these 50 hours and make that up.
Yeah, well, I remember sitting in my job network. I haven't had to do that because I've been doing voluntary work 15 hours a week for a few years now. But until, you know, three or four years ago, I was having to do that. And we were sitting around talking in between sessions at one of these courses. And, yeah, look, some of the people there could benefit from the course theoretically, or this course, the resume course, but only if the job was available for them, you know, and they know it's not, you know, they know they're in the situation, health situation. Others, like, I can't remember even the name, it was some new agey sort of a name, which was basically about building up your confidence, you know, so that the people were going to, you know, because they feel better about themselves, somehow that's going to transfer down to the employer and the employer's more likely to employ them. Mm. Of course, you know, theoretically, you might say that if they actually got an interview, but the point is 90% of the people don't get an interview. Mm. In fact, I remember doing my, whatever it was, 10, 15 job applications a fortnight, and maybe one in 10 would actually even respond.
Yeah.
Never mind giving me an interview, mm. you know. Mm. So it was, again, it's just one of those deceptions to try and create the impression of a viable process, whereas it's only about saving money and punishment.
Mm.
You know.
Mm.
So, anything else before we move on to the public transport?
Yeah, there's there's more. Parents will have to find a third party to back up their relationship claims in order to receive the single parent pension. Now, single parents are 90% women. Often coming out of domestic violence situations. So that's going to make it significantly harder for them to access payments quickly in a timely manner. So there's also people that are affected by drug and alcohol abuse. Dependence will no longer be eligible for disability support pension. I think that's absolutely appalling.
Mm.
They're trying to make it a matter of individual, you know, problem rather than a social problem and one that people need support with.
Well, for many years, the people in drug rehabilitation, who the experts, people like John Wozniak, I think, from Sydney University, I think he is. But anyway, people who are in the know about it have said you've got to treat dependencies like those as illnesses, not as failures of individual will. But of course, conservative ideology says that's what it is. You are an unworthy or an undeserving person if you become dependent on these things.
Yeah.
You know, never mind all the rich people that they know or them themselves who are dependent on cocaine or alcohol or whatever, but that's hidden behind the doors until it finally comes out, maybe in a you know, tell all in the tabloids.
Yeah.
But most often doesn't come out at all. So that's that argument, isn't it?
And adding salt to the wound, you will no longer be able to be considered that you're, you know, as an acceptable excuse that any problems that you have with drug and alcohol addiction can be an excuse for not turning up to one of these mutual obligation activities. So, it goes on. We could go on.
Yeah.
It's a very, very nasty bill.
Also highlighting how many NGOs and people like that have come out and opposed these attacks on drug addiction as well. We had, I think, ACOS, AMA, a lot of other medical institutions say that, you know, for the mandatory drug testing that has been defeated. But, you know, they just bring in something else like this. And, it's, you know, it's really the same, you know.
The one win.
Sorry, just that was people with debilitating mental health are probably going to seek drugs or some kind of out. And, like, you know, mental health is a serious thing and you should be on the disability support pension if you are debilitated. So,
yeah, but of course they make that as hard as possible because it's harder to pin down mental illness, as my family knows. Yeah.
The one thing that we managed collectively to get taken out of this bill is the mandatory drug testing that they were about to pioneer, which meant that all people on in various areas, three particular regions for starters, they were going to instigate mandatory drug testing before you could receive payments. That, thankfully, has been dropped because it's
No doubt it's still on the back burner, though.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And they've already, the LNP has already said that they're going to be revisiting it later in the year. So
I guess the summary is there's lots of nasties. There's not one massive blow to the people on welfare, but it's the death of the thousand cuts sort of thing, both in terms of attacking their already measly incomes, and I suppose in a broader sense, their human dignity is part of the pressure being put on people here, stressing more and more that notion that you really don't deserve this, you have to jump through massive amounts of hoops in order to get it, rather than it being a human right.
Yeah. You know? And for Anti-Poverty Network, it's not just a question of this particular bill. This bill is really, really nasty, but we also oppose the status quo. Mm. What already exists is already brutalising and punitive for people who are struggling, and more people are. So it's a question of both opposing the status quo and this particular welfare bill at the same time. That's our position.
Yeah. But, of course, the way in which this is contrasted is with these increasingly nonsensical employment figures when they're saying, oh, well, look, there's less and less excuse for people being on welfare, and we're plowing more money into this, and there's this, you know. So you haven't got, you know, an excuse to stand on, is their kind of argument. And the mainstream media perpetuate this nonsense about unemployment, about employment going up and up and up. And we all know what most of that employment is. It's very part-time, very insecure, very exploitative. We just heard a little bit this week ourselves about one of our family members who happens to be from New Zealand is being, you know, terribly ripped off by an employer because of her visa status and her age, no doubt. So that's the sort of jobs that we're getting, if there are any jobs at all.
Yeah. The official figures at the moment are 5.4%, and it's just a load of nonsense. Mm. I only just actually learnt recently. I thought that part of the major problem was that if you hadn't if you'd worked for 1 hour or more, you weren't counted as unemployed. But actually, it's worse than that. The ABS counts unemployment figures as people who simply haven't applied for a job in the previous month.
Mm.
Now, in a job market like the one that we have at the moment, that is truly appalling. So 5.4%. Absolute nonsense. Mm. The Roy Morgan polling company puts the combined amount of people who are unemployed and underemployed at more like 20% of the Australian workforce.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's what we're talking
and
about.
And, of course, the other major, one of the major indications that it's nonsense is the increased usage of things like food co-ops and other wealth, non-government welfare services for people to simply feed themselves. That's gone up enormously. I've seen figures from various groups on that one.
Yeah,
Are people suddenly becoming twice as hungry or something, or is it just that more and more people are becoming desperate?
Yeah, I think I saw the latest figures were just from various food groups. In SA was 100,000 reports of people seeking some emergency food relief, and you know, a lot of those people would be on welfare or low income, and then think about the people who don't access the food relief that they potentially could, I guess.
But so that's 100,000 instances in a state of about 1.5, 1.6 million, and as you said, there'll be people who, for reasons of pride or whatever, won't do it, would never do it. So that's
public transport. You
know, yeah.
And also, those are the official places where you can go to get relief. But there are, and this is really heartening, there are organisations springing up all over the place. There's a group up in, I think they're based up in the north, called Pass a Plate, where community members are actually helping each other. So people will post and say, look, you know, can somebody help me out? We need some food. And other people will post and say, I have some extra food. And so it's actually organised between people and negotiated between each other. So people will post and say, look, you know, can somebody help me out? We need some food. And other people will post and say, I have some extra food. And so it's actually organised between people and negotiated between people. So all of that is happening as well.
Well, that's the real, the genuine mutual obligation, the mutual obligation that people actually feel for each other rather than the bullshit nonsense that you get from governments and from these job network people.
It's the only mutual obligation that should exist. We absolutely oppose the entire mutual obligation system and the whole job service provider.
So we're going back to APN, but this time we're talking about APN's initiative and their free public transport policy. Just briefly explain it to me. What's the idea?
So I think this is probably one of the biggest things that affects people on low incomes is the cost of public transport. I know most of my friends struggle with public transport. So what we want to do is kind of get the campaign going by getting a free public transport for all low-income people, not just on welfare, but like if you're earning, you know, under 20K, that's pretty low. So I think it's definitely feasible. It's half of it's privately owned anyway. So and I think that. Is it paid by taxpayers anyway, the public?
Well, this is one of the things that we want to research.
Yeah.
In the broader and more long term, the public transport campaign is for is part of our state election strategy. But in the long term, what we want is research that it tells us exactly how much the state government is subsidising the privatised buses by. Because it's our guess that it's quite considerable, given that on a lot of at a lot of times in the day, the buses are not particularly full, so they're not dependent on how much money they're bringing in, and we don't think that that's entirely covered by peak time profits. So that. As I understand it, that research doesn't yet exist, so it's part of our long-term strategy.
Well, in any case, the peak time profits go to those private companies, as who are then paid as well by the public purse. I mean, it reminds me of the fact that it's not the same area, but many years ago it was found out that under the deal between the Victorian government and the Portland aluminium smelter, for long periods of the time, not only were they not paying any money for electricity, which is incredibly high use in aluminium smelters, but they're actually getting money back from the state government to run the smelter. Now, you know, public contracts with private developers under neoliberalism can often be written that way. And my strong suspicion is that that's the case with the public transport area.
Yeah.
So, all right, what's the sort of things that people struggle with in terms of, I understand you've collected lots of stories from people.
Yeah, we've got some testimonials here, and they'll give listeners a pretty broad context for what people have to contend with in their daily lives. But this is one. As an unemployed person who struggles to pay rent each week, the added cost of public transport fares means I do not venture anywhere that I cannot walk to. Excuse me. The cost of catching public transport is an added cost I cannot afford. I say it every day. There are things just about every day where if there was not a friend or family member to take me, I would not be going. Here's another one. I would be able to stay a whole lot more connected to the community if I didn't have to worry about the cost of public transport. Most weeks I'm a few days without money, so making it to different events can really depend on what day of the week it is. It's for my son's appointments in the city. If it's for my son's appointment in the city, I always make sure the money will be there as I know about them 3 months prior. There's no difference between $5 and $2.60 when you have no money. Another one. I've had to put my phone into cash converters a few times and use another cheap phone, as three people using public transport is roughly between $135 to $150 a month on a Metro card with concessions. I use the bus four times a day, 4 days a week. That is two buses there, two buses home. And my daughters use two buses a day to and from school. And another child needs to have for community access days with school, and that can be four trips a week. My girls have had to stay home from school or excursions, and I've nearly not been able to go to work if I'm not able to get a monthly pass, as it is more expensive any other way. Maybe you said...
Yeah, and there's also one which is pretty touching and also just sad. I think we hear this a lot from teachers, but it's from a teacher, and it says, as an SA high school teacher with a school in a socioeconomically disadvantaged area, I often had to give my students money to catch the bus home. One child who lived across town had only his tiny BMX to get home to school, and when his bike was stolen, had to ride a scooter on an hour's journey across the city and main roads. This obviously had a terrible impact on his education, and he missed many days, especially in the winter when it was raining. His family could not afford to pay for his year 8 camp, even with the extended payment offered by the school. As the mother said, it's still money we just don't have.
Mm. And it's important to remind people that we're, of course, living in one of the most spread out cities in the world. We're living in a car dependent city, and therefore everything is further apart than it would be in more compact cities. And of course, included in that is the very mutual obligations we were talking about earlier, about getting to job network places and getting to job interviews, if you ever get one of those, and, you know, if you manage to get a low-income job, getting to that low-income job. So the environmental conditions make it harder again for people without public transport or without cheap public transport.
That's absolutely correct. But also what keeps coming up for us over and over again, and you may have heard in some of those testimonials, is simply social connection, because one of the things that happens to people in the lowest 20% of the socioeconomic hierarchy in this country is they simply get isolated, and it's how important it is for people to stay in contact with each other, and obviously transport's a major part of that. But also, as part of our campaign, a long-term campaign about this, we want to highlight how the infrequency of services in low-income areas, inconveniences those reliant on public transport. We think that's really, really important, because the further out into the suburbs you go, the less ability you've got to get to places more discerningly, you know, so that it's not just from your home to the super to the shopping mall, but to all sorts of different places that can improve and increase the social life of yourself in the community.
Well, if someone used to be in the public transport organisation, one of the key issues about car dependent cities like this is that cross town transport is very, very difficult for public transport. Radial transport from the outer suburbs to the city can take a long time, but that's at least the routes are there. But there's very little radial, there's very little cross-town transport in Adelaide. There's no railway lines, and there's only, I think it's one or two bus routes that connect the various radial lines. So that makes it hard, and as you said, the hierarchy of all cities is, or most cities, we've got the donut cities in the US as a counterexample, but most cities, the poorer you are, the further out you are, and therefore the more you struggle with public transport, the longer it takes. And if, for instance, your bus breaks down in a hot day and you miss a new mutual obligation, then you'll get a demerit point, won't you,
into
the new system.
Yeah.
You can't use the bus broken down as an excuse, can you?
And actually, that's come up in our group, this whole idea that we also live in a very harsh climate. And the other day there was an instance of a friend of mine who got on a bus. It was 44 degrees and she didn't have any money on a Metro card, and unfortunately that driver told her that she had to get off the bus. No fare, no ride.
Mm.
Now, I have to say that from what I've observed, a lot of bus drivers do allow people on, particularly in those sort of extreme conditions. This particular one had obviously taken managerial directives a little bit too literally and disallowed her to get on the bus. She then ran management at Adelaide Metro and they told her, well, we're very sorry that he was rude to you, but if you don't have the fare, you're not allowed on the bus. And she had the wherewithal. She's a young woman and relatively resilient, but she had the wherewithal to say to this person, but what if I was disabled? What if I was elderly? You could have been putting me at serious risk. So there's a whole pile of reasons that why we want public transport to be free for all welfare recipients.
Yeah, I think it is. It's unsafe. It's harming us further, and you see an increase in the criminalisation of people not paying for their fares. You see the propaganda meant to scare us. You know, pay your fare or like be a fare player, or like all that shit. You know, and you see police on the trains, on the buses. Like, why are police checking your tickets? Why there's undercover Metro ticket inspectors now? Like, they're just going to great lengths to really attack the poor even more. And
Well, as a regular user of Adelaide Railway Station, I've been through there a number of times when there've been a line of police with sniffer dogs, you know, checking you out as for drugs, presumably. But the point is that that's further intimidation of people using the public transport service. You know, it's not exactly a stress-reducing thing, and we all know that stress is one of the major products of being on a low income and on the margins.
One of our members pointed out something really interesting recently around the, because of course seniors already receive, they can go free on public transport in off-peak times between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock and
7 and 12. Not on Saturdays though.
But not on Saturdays. But what she was pointing out was that that was actually a kind of initiative, not to be kind to seniors, but to stop them jamming up the public transport system during peak hours.
During peak hours, that's right. You know, useless people for the economy.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, it sounds like some sort of indulgence, but it's not. Yeah,
but you can see how the public transport system ripples out into all kinds of really important and significant social realities for people's lives.
Well, take the last few months, for example, of my own personal experience. The Outer Harbour line has been down. It's only just reopened a week or so ago. That meant that it was replaced by a bus, and that bus took twice as long to get to the city. You know, instead of 24 minutes, it was at least 50 minutes and sometimes an hour, depending on the traffic conditions, because, of course, you know, trains don't have to worry about other traffic on the road, but buses do. And then in the city, we've got these changes to the trams, which closed down King William Street and North Terrace for part of the time. Now, yeah, presumably there's some benefit going to come, but these extensions of the tram lines are cosmetic mostly in terms of most people in the city. They're
not
only
functional.
An extension of short times. They're not exactly offering people a great new service, but they are status symbols, I suppose. And so, and I won't even mention today when we at the Tour Down Under closing down the city. But it affects an awful lot. It affects a great deal in people's lives, particularly people who don't have cars and who are dependent on the public transport.
And, you know, some of the counter-arguments relate to how in South Australia we have amongst the cheapest fares in Australia. And that is actually true. But when you counterpose that to those figures that were in the story that I read out earlier of how much it costs a woman who's on welfare with three children to transport an entire family around, the correlation between what her income is and what she's spending on transport is enormous.
Yeah, and also, I mean, Sydney and Melbourne, if you want to contrast with them, their transport fares are more expensive. They're not enormously so. I've been there in both places recently. I walked there, of course. but they've got a far better train service. Their train services, and in Melbourne, tram service, their public transport systems are much more extensive. A very large proportion of the people who work in the central city of Sydney travel there by public transport. Mm. We got double-decker trains, etc. And, of course, it's a much bigger city, but the point being they're paying a bit more but for a much better service. You know? So,
yeah.
You know, let's not laud the Adelaide system too much. There's been very little money been put into it for a long time.
Mm. Just one other scenario that came up the other day, again from another member of ours, and this time it's related to her neighbour, who is one of the tsunami of underemployed workers that there are in Australia and growing by the day. She actually couldn't go to one of her shifts because she doesn't have enough money for public transport. And she's working, so we're talking about the working poor here. And so she cycles. It's an hour and a half to work and an hour and a half back. And it was highly inclement weather. We all went through it. It was 43.7 degrees or something like that on that day, and she couldn't make a shift. That's an entire day's pay lost because of an inability to just simply be able to use public transport.
Okay, we haven't got all that much longer left, but any other issues about the public transport campaign you want to raise?
Well, I think I'll just mention about the campaign. So we're interested in hearing from more stories about how public transport and the cost of public transport affects you.
Yes, please.
And
what do people do with that? How do they get it to APN?
So you could email us at antipovertynetwork.sa@gmail.com. We're very active on Facebook and Twitter, actually. But, yeah, if you can get us there, that'd be great. And even senior card holders as well, because we want to know, if that is really working for them and if they're enjoying that and, if they would like to spread that across for all. In solidarity, I guess, for all low-income earners.
The more testimonials we get, the better, because we're intending to have a visit to the State Transport Minister and to various other key political actors in the public transport sector, and we'd like to get them a full, clear picture of the social ramifications of this.
Okay, well, look, I'll just spend, 6 or 7 minutes or so on the nuclear issue that I talked about before, and you're both welcome to comment or have your say about it, because it affects all of us, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Thanks for talking to me about APN and the public transport campaign.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Pleasure. All right, so this issue is that connected to, though not seeming so, the preparations for war against North Korea, there was a so-called false alarm delivered in Hawaii last week. And that's a population of 1.5 million people, so, about the same size as South Australia. Cell phones lit up with the message, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii, seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. Television and radio broadcasts were interrupted with the chilling announcement that a missile may impact on sea or land within minutes. This is not a drill. And for 38 minutes, residents of and visitors to Hawaii were confronted face-to-face with nuclear Armageddon. And remember, even though it's got 1.5 million, this Hawaii is not that big. It's not a very big place at all. Parents frantically sought to find and protect their children. Families said last goodbyes, and people desperately sought largely non-existent shelter in anticipation of a nuclear blast. There was also a false alarm in Japan a few days later. But the fact that this event rapidly disappeared from the front pages of major newspapers and is being reduced to a secondary story by television news is itself the disturbing indication of how much more is involved in this Hawaii ballistic missile warning than the public is being told. So what was supposed to have happened was that an employee typed into the computer missile alert rather than test missile alert. Now, how implausible is that? First of all, that, and this was supposedly a junior employee, the unnamed individual supposedly selected the wrong computer menu option. Might not even be typed in. But anyway, keying in possibly missile alert right instead of test missile alert. It's very incredible in lots of ways. Given the record of the U.S. government in staging provocations and launching wars based upon lies, not only severe skepticism, but outright suspicion is called for. And one other element that is worth saying, just a couple of days before in the major Hawaii newspaper, one of the U.S. military said you should be preparing for the possibility of nuclear war. Coincidence? No, I don't think so.
And it wasn't it also within a day or two of Tillerson actually beginning to outline how many planes were in the region and how many could be affected if a North Korean nuclear missile was to and so forth. So it was definitely in a context.
And this person was not being named, supposedly prevent them being lynched by outraged citizens. But surely they've got a right to tell their story, their side of the story. And even if the incident was what they say it is, triggered by a single mistaken key punch, that doesn't explain why it took a full excruciating 38 minutes for the authorities to send out a follow-up message announcing that the warning had been a false alarm. 38 minutes of panic? About 38 minutes is a shorter time than it takes for the missiles to arrive in some cases. What does it mean? Well, what does it do to people? It makes them more alert about the possibility, but it also makes them more alarmed. It presumably gives more support for a more aggressive position, or certainly towards a first strike position where the U.S. wouldn't supposedly have to worry about a North Korean nuclear missile. And it puts further blame on North Korea. Oh, ultimately, even though this is a false alarm, they're the people that have got us afraid. So that's all part of it. But it also is a simple test of preparation by the U.S. government. Of course, the fact that they haven't got any shelters kind of indicates where their priorities are. They got shelters for them and for government officials. there's not a shortage of that. But, of course, there's no mass shelter system for citizens in the U.S., which there are in China and Russia, interestingly enough. You know, we're supposedly, America's supposedly a democracy, and they're supposedly not, but they've actually protected some of their citizens. Obviously, a lot of people wouldn't be able to access them in smaller towns, but a lot of their citizens would be able to access them, and there's hardly any for ordinary citizens. But we all heard the stories of the missile bunkers for the politicians and the military, and the plane that the president or the whoever has the button, whichever is that person, is up there. So what's the general paper for the liberal left, sort of the liberal left establishment in the U.S., the New York Times, had a story pointing to the 1983 Korean airliner incident as an example of how an unintended nuclear war could erupt. That is when the Soviet air defense fighter shot down a Korean jumbo jet. But it fails to point out that it's now been established that that jet, not the passengers themselves, but the jet, was directed deliberately over a major Soviet base on the Isles of Sakhalin, which are distributed between the Soviet Union, or now Russia, and Japan. And that was the reason why the jets were scrambled. Now, that doesn't excuse the Soviets for shooting down what was clearly a civilian airliner, but it indicates that it was a plot that the Americans were trying to test the Soviet air defenses. So these Korean passengers were basically killed as part of a war of chicken between two superpowers of the time. Mm. And really, that's the indication of where we're all in. We're in that position. We're in Australia. We've got nuclear bases here that make Australia a target because of our blind adherence, or the government's blind adherence to the policy of clinging to the US in some way or other. Mm. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that there have been further indications of US preparations for war with North Korea. I mean, we've been reassured somewhat by this thing about the Winter Olympics. But at the same time, the US has quietly moved heavy firepower like nuclear bombers and aircraft carriers to the region while the preparations for the Winter Olympics are going on. They probably won't do it while the Winter Olympics are on, but if they do attack, they may do it just after that. Mm. Now, it may be that this initiative is coming from the Pentagon rather than from Trump, because there's some indications that Trump wants a bit more detente, and he gave the say-so to the South Koreans to agree with the North Koreans about the Winter Olympics joint team and also to the postponement of the joint exercises. But at the same time, we all know that there are division in the United States government, and some of them are even worse than Trump. Trump may shoot his mouth off like an ignoramus on Twitter, etc., but other people actually prepare for war. Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations, is one of the worst of them. Mm. She's aggressive to everyone except the Israel lobby and other U.S. Direct allies.
As a counter to all that stuff, how significant do you think it is, this kind of detente between North and South Korea? From what I've read from peace activism, it's quite significant.
Well, I think it indicates that the North Koreans are willing to have a different attitude to South Korea than they have to the United States. And the interesting thing is that various places around the world, US allies are distancing themselves to some degree from the US because they think, well, maybe these people haven't got good judgment and maybe they're on a losing side. I don't just mean militarily, but economically, because China is shifting further and further to a system where petrol or oil is traded in their currency rather than the Americans. So Pakistan has now gone offside with the U.S., South Korea maybe, a number of others as well. The America First policy seems to be, you know, leading to desertion by the people. So anyway, look, we run out of time, but it's an interesting time to be living in. So we hope things stay peaceful, or at least for some of us, because it's not peaceful for a lot of people. So that's us for the week, Peace of the Act.